Did you ever open up for any national bands at the Dayton's Top Ten Club?
Not that I recall at Dayton's. We did at Danceland.
Oh, who were the bands?
We backed up a group called Jan and Dean. Oh, this was a strange gig, strange experience. But we got their playlist for the show they were going to do and the keys and everything, and we learned all their music and then got to the gig. And we didn't really have a chance to rehearse because they come whirling in right before we were to start. We started playing, and they started singing, and they were so out of key that it was hilarious, quite frankly. We were just laughing our butts off behind them because they sounded so terrible. Then after the first song was over, they turned around, and we had a little talk, and discovered that we had been given the wrong keys for the songs that they were going to sing. It wasn't them who were wrong, it was us. But we were provided with the wrong keys for their songs. So we had to transpose on the spot, which, you know, you might imagine had a little bit of an effect on the quality of what we were doing. Because we had their stuff down perfect, but it was perfect in the wrong keys. And, you know, musicians in those days, at that stage of development, we could transpose, but it wouldn't be a perfect transposition. So we lost a little bit of play quality during that. But the show went on, and it was just fine after that, and they sounded great, and we had a good time, and they had a good time. So that's something that happened with Jan and Dean.
Now, you're doing more vocal songs, I assume, at this point. What bands are you covering at this point in time?
Oh, we're singing all kinds of things by now. We're doing four-part harmony frequently. We're doing the Beach Boys, the Beatles, Animals, The Who, Mamas and Papas, the Young Rascals, the Rolling Stones, the Troggs. Remember them?
Wild
Righteous
Thing.
Brothers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wild Thing. The Grassroots. The Temptations, Chuck Berry, Eddie Cochran, Richie Valens, Sam Cooke, Barry McGuire, The Drifters, The Coasters, Safaris, we're all over the board on the music we played. As long as it was danceable, we did it.
Now, who was doing the vocals at this point?
Well, we all did them, depending on the song. The Beach Boys, all four of us sang. And same with the Mamas and Papas. If it was a four-part harmony, we all sang. If it was two-part, two of us sang. Usually it was Mike and me for the harmony on the two parts. Everly Brothers, we did some of that. That was Dave and I did Everly Brothers because Mike had a little bit of a waver to his voice. That's not what you call it, but David's voice was clear and straight, and so was mine, and so we could harmonize a little better.
Now I understand there's a day of infamy in the United States of America, November 22nd, 1963. It's the assassination of JFK. What do you recall about that day?
Well, when we heard it, they announced it over the intercom in school. I was in school that day, and that night we played at Camden Hall in North Minneapolis. That was a kind of a quiet night.
What do you recall about June 12, 1964, at Reggie's Danceland in Excelsior?
Oh, Reggie's Danceland. Yeah, Danceland. Reggie was another one of those Twin Cities characters. He was a lot of fun. Anyway, that night, we were booked at Danceland, and there was going to be another group there, too. Pretty much nobody had ever heard of them. And so we went there, and I walked up on stage. After we set up, I walked to the back of the stage. The dressing room was behind the stage at Danceland. I walked down into the three or four steps down into the dressing room, and sitting over on the bench alongside the wall were these two really scraggly-looking characters, long hair, dirty clothes, skinny. They looked really looked bad, like they needed some food or something. And they turned out that the band that we were preceding was the Rolling Stones on their first U.S. tour. And the two guys in the dressing room were Mick Jagger and...
Keith Richards.
Yeah, Keith Richards. Little did we know, huh?
Do you recall if there were other bands there playing before the Stones as well, or just you?
I don't recall that. I think probably we packed up our gear as they were setting up, put our gear in the car, and then we came back in and listened to them a couple of times for a couple of songs, and then we left. So I don't know if there was anybody played after them or not.
Do you recall the reaction of the crowd to the Rolling Stones that night?
Well, there weren't very many people. It wasn't a full house. It was, I don't know, maybe half full, and it didn't seem like there was a lot of excitement. I don't think the kids in the Twin Cities were quite ready for something like the Rolling Stones at that point. I think they just didn't know how to handle it.
Let's go to
But I have to tell you that from the first time they started playing until today, their sound has not changed very much, and so they probably sounded pretty much the same back then.
Let's go to your first 45, recorded October 13, 1964. What is the story behind your first 45 on the Soma label, and what were the two songs?
That recording session was Little Latin Loopy Lou, which was the one that was the hit, and then Yo-Yo was on the B-side, and Mike sang Yo-Yo, and David and I did the harmony on Little Latin Loopy Lou. We went into K-Bank, we got set up and everything, and they did the engineering thing, and so we played Little Latin Loopy Lou the first time. I thought it was, you know, perfect. There weren't any mistakes. Ira wanted us to play it a couple more times. He later told me because he wanted to get the very best out of us that we could provide. And they ended up using the first take anyway. And then Yo-Yo was the B side, and Mike sang that. I think we sang that two or three times. Then the session was over.
So Ira is basically the one who's producing the session, correct?
Yeah, Ira.
Was Dick Shapiro there or not?
I don't remember that. He may have been. Dick was the agent. He was the booker. He did the book.
Okay.
And Ira did more of the management sort of thing. But Dick could have been there. He might have been there, actually.
Okay, so your record comes out, Little Latin Loopy Lou, in late 1964. And what happens with your record and the local radio stations?
I think it entered the list at 30 or 31 or 32 or something like that, and then it took a few weeks for it to catch on, but once it caught on, it went right up to the top and stayed there for 3 weeks, and I believe it was on the top 10 for 11 weeks total.
Now you're talking about WDGY?
WDGY, and it was up there in KDWB too. Both played it, and it I don't remember how far up it got on KDWB, but on WDGY it went up to number one, which was kind of cool, you know.
So my records show Little Latin Loopy Lou hits number one on WDGY on January 23, 1965, and stays at the top position for 3 weeks. And I also understand that your song got airplay in some regional markets as well. Do you recall those other markets?
Oh, there was Chicago. We played in Chicago a bunch of times at various different venues, in Kansas City. I think it hit number one in Kansas City, and we played there at least two times, and then Omaha and St. Louis. And it may have been in some other markets too, but I didn't know about them.
Was there a difference going out of town playing to crowds as opposed to the local venues you played here and the crowds you met here in the Twin Cities?
Yeah, there's always a difference when something someone from out of town comes into your area. It seems like there's more excitement than there is with somebody local, but, you know, that's just my take on it.
Now, I assume with a hit record, a local hit record, and some regional airplay as well, it would have to assume the price for the Chancellors must have gone up.
Well, back in those days, it wasn't like it is now, but I think that we did start making a lot more money, and we did start booking a lot more places, and, you know, wider variety of places and larger places as well. So probably half again on the money, and maybe even double the money a few times. And, you know, we started doing pretty well financially. At one point, when I was in 19, I was making more money than my father.
That seems to be a common story from that mid-60s era for local bands. I've heard that from a number of musicians. I'd like to hear about your job at Dayton's Top 10 Club in Minneapolis when you were sort of besieged by fans.
Oh, yeah. I don't recall if this was the inaugural Dayton's Top 10 or not. It seems like it might have been, but I can't be sure because it's so long ago. But we were warming up, you know, tuning up and everything, and going through our litany of preparations before the gig began. Doors on the Top 10 auditorium, there was a set of, I think it was six double doors all in a row on the one wall, and they started shaking and banging. We heard banging on them, and pretty soon one of them broke open, and then another one, and pretty soon they all broke open, and these hundreds of kids came just flowing into the room like water. It was amazing to see. It was I guess they were really excited about being there.
So you must have started your gig a little early then at that point.
We probably did. We probably started right away once we saw that. I mean, there had to be some way to keep order. And I'm sure that the management there probably told us, start playing, start playing.
Now, I understand you go back to K-Bank for another session on May 12, 1965, and record 5 songs. What were those 5 songs you recorded?
Well, that session included So Fine. That was a cover of Fiesta's hit from 1959. And I'm a Man from Bo Diddley. That was a 1955 deal. Dave sang that. We all sang on So Fine, by the way. Charlie Brown, you know, He's a Clown, that Charlie Brown. That was the Coasters from 1959. I Can Tell from Bo Diddley. And a song called Surf Beat from a group called the Challengers, pardon me, from 1963.
So out of those songs, you put out So Fine on the A side and I'm a Man on the B side. And what happens with this 45 now, your second 45 on the Soma label?
That one didn't do as good as Little Lad Lick Blue. It got up to number 8, and it was on the charts for about 7 weeks. It just didn't do as well. It wasn't really as exciting. You know, the rhythm wasn't there. It didn't work, put it that way. I think the reason it got onto the charts at all was because of Little Lad Loopy Lou. Back in those days, if you had one hit, they'd generally give your second offering a chance.
And that's WDGY once again?
I think so, yeah.
And how about KDWB? Did they play So Fine?
Well, yeah, they played it too. It got some airplay in the other Midwestern markets as well. Just didn't take off like Little Lad Loopy Lou did.
Now, the Chancellors were included on the Big Hits of In America, Volume 2, and they had the 4 sides from your 245s on that album. I imagine that was a nice accomplishment to have.
You know, I didn't really know that that was taking place until after the fact, and I happened to pick up an album and I saw our name on it. They took the recordings that had already been made and put them together on this compilation, which is just fine. I'm glad to have it, you know, the Big Hits of Mid-America. We weren't actually included in the loop on that one.
I assume you were not included in the financial loop.
No, that too. I wasn't anyway.
I think that's kind of the way it worked back then, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't know who did get the money, if there was any to be made on it, but I didn't see any of it.
Let's jump ahead to the Symphony Ball. On May 7, 1966, at Southdale Shopping Center in Edina, what do you recall about that job?
Hubert Humphrey was there, and his wife.
Muriel.
Muriel, yeah, Muriel Humphrey. They were there, and it was a big deal. There was lots of glitz and glamour there, and we just played the normal list. I don't remember who else played on that at that thing. There might have been other bands there.
Well, there's a photo that was in the local newspaper. The caption read, "Band with a Beat." St. Louis Park members of the Chancellors are Dave Rifkin and John Hughes. It shows those two band members. They appear to be wearing three-piece suits with vests.
Yeah, okay, we wore those. We had three-piece vested suits, a couple of different ones.
Did your stage clothes go through changes over the time?
Oh, yeah. We varied from Pendleton overshirts to three-piece vested suits, just regular cotton shirts tucked in. We had several different uniforms. Back in those days, there was, I think they called them the Baldies, and they were known, it was a youth group. Some they call it a gang now, but back in those days, they wore khaki trousers, tucked in blue or yellow cotton long sleeve shirts, and that was and nice belts. And they were all nice and neat and everything. And we dressed like that also.
I know there's one photo of you guys wearing saddle shoes.
Oh yeah, that was with the Pendletons. We wore Pendleton overshirts. I think they were black slacks and black and white saddle shoes. That was the deal. That was the thing back then.
And the Baldies were supposedly the enemies of the Greasers. Is that how it worked?
That's right. Yeah, the Baldies and the Greasers. If you were a Greaser, you were not a Baldy. And if you were a Baldy, you had short hair or no hair. You shaved it off. But the Greasers were the ones with the long hair and combed back and forth, you know.
The old Elvis Presley look.
One of the trash men had his hair like that, you know. And they'd wear the black pointed leather shoes and the motorcycle jackets and stuff like that. That was the stereotype.
Now, looking at my list here, it appears that John Hughes left the band on May 16, 1966, in order to enter the military service. Who did you find to replace John?
We got a kid named Ron Butwin. I think Dick Shapiro might have mentioned him. He was a really good drummer, too. He took right over for John, and it didn't take him long at all to get into the rhythm with all of our songs. So after John left for the military, it was Ron.
And then at some point here in the summer of 66, Dave Rifkin also exits the band. And who takes over on lead guitar?
When David quit, John was gone, and then David quit. So we decided, Mike and I decided to reorganize the band. At that point, Ron Butwin left also. So it was Mike and me, and we got Ralph Berger, and we got Jim Farragher for drums.
Did you fly to Kansas City for jobs on a private jet?
That's another correction. It wasn't a private jet. It felt like a private jet because we were the only ones on board.
Oh. So it was a schedule.
And John did go with us to Kansas City. He was still in the band at that point.
So it was a small airplane.
No, it was a jet. It was a regular commercial jet.
Oh, it was a commercial jet, and
both times. But we were the only ones on it, so it felt like it was private. I talked to John about that this morning, and he did remember going to Kansas City on a jet, but not a private one. So he did go. He was with us at Kansas City.